Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Good morning. Hard to believe, but it's been only 1 week since Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was seized by US forces. And frankly, since then, almost every day has brought a fresh all-caps headline. But let's start at the beginning. And on Monday's Morning Ireland, Audrey got this analysis from Dr. Barry Cannon, Associate Professor at Maynooth University, specialising in Latin American politics.
Why do you think he ordered this level of intervention on Venezuela? Is it all about oil, or is it more about laying down a marker about US dominance and power in the region?
Well, the second, I would say, the US did it because the US can. You know, we can see by the international reaction that there's very little sort of blowback in the United States for doing this. If you look at the reactions of the European Union, for example, and the main European Union powers, there's been no actual condemnation of the US actions, despite the fact that it is clearly against international law, because it's against the principle of sovereignty upon which international law is based. And as the Antonio Guterres said, the Secretary General of the United Nations, it sets a very dangerous precedent. But, you know, nothing's going to happen to the United States. There'll be discussion about it in the United Nations today, in the Security Council, and the US will veto whatever resolution comes out against it. So in that sense, the US can do this. The US has always done this sort of thing in Latin America. Why they're doing it? Yes, it could be because of the oil. Of course, Venezuela's got the largest deposits of oil in the world. It is lying there largely underutilized. And the United States and this presidency in particular is obsessed with oil. So, yes, I think that's probably a very important motivation. But it's also to send a signal to the region that the United States is boss in the region, that no one can contradict it, and that if anybody does anything which contradicts what the United States wants for that region and for the United States itself, it will be punished, and will be punished severely. And already we've seen threats against Colombia, threats against Mexico, and threats against Cuba in the wake of this attack on Venezuela. And of course, there is still a live threat over Venezuela at the moment as we speak.
And as the world struggled to understand just what had happened, the same question was asked repeatedly. Why? Why now? And to what end? For an American perspective on Thursday's News at 1, Rachel was joined by Todd Robinson, who had served as acting US ambassador to Venezuela during Donald Trump's first term.
Why do you believe that President Trump decided to take this action against Nicolas Maduro now?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I think the messages coming out of this White House have been really bad. The first reason they gave was that that this was a law enforcement drug action. The second reason they gave was that this was some kind of effort for democratic transition. And then the third reason they gave was about oil. And, you know, it could be all of those reasons. It could be none of those reasons. But the way this White House is messaging, it's really hard for people to understand. And I think in an action like this, where you go in and extract the leader of a country, you should be very clear about why you're doing it. And I think they've been, I don't think they've been very clear about this.
Meanwhile, as the seized president protested his innocence against narco-terrorism charges in a New York courtroom, other countries in Latin America wondered if they might soon draw the eye of President Trump. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Katie put this to Hal Hodson of The Economist.
Hal, obviously it's not just Colombia in the firing line. Cuba and Mexico also feeling the heat.
Yeah, that's right. Cuba is in big trouble no matter what Donald Trump does now. It was already a totally broken country with, you know, energy infrastructure that's falling apart, no ability to import supplies because of embargoes. And now it has lost one of its most important sponsors and, importantly, has lost the oil that Venezuela used to give it in exchange for various Cuban services like medical doctors that would go to Caracas and vitally security services that failed to protect Maduro from the Americans. So Cuba, you know, is in trouble anyway. And I think when you think about, you know, what will Trump do next? Where might he strike next? Bizarre as it is to think like that. I don't think Cuba's very high on the list. Mexico's different. Mexico has a very, very serious problem with drug gangs. You know, it is to some extent run by those drug gangs. And the idea there is that the Americans might move to strike those gangs on Mexican soil without the go-ahead from and cooperation from Claudia Sheinbaum and her government.
That's Mexico and Cuba. But what about Colombia? An operation there sounds good to me, says President Trump.
I don't think the idea is necessarily that the Americans would try and take Gustavo Petro out, I think the idea is that they might try and do similar to what they're talking about in Mexico, which is strike drug cartels in that country under the banner of fighting drugs and fighting gangs. But even doing that, you know, not talking about taking out democratically elected heads of state, even just an American strike without the cooperation permission of either the Mexican or the Colombian government would be an incredibly dramatic event that would have, you know, really huge, very kind of, you know, frankly, hard to predict consequences.
Ah, yes, hard to predict consequences, which brings us to Greenland, very much on the agenda for the US. Its acquisition deemed a national security priority. They might put in an offer, or failing that, they are not ruling out military force. Of course, the Danes might have something to say about this, never mind the people living in Greenland. On the News at One, Rachel spoke to Danish MP Trine Mack, who is a member of that Parliament's Greenland Committee.
I think it's fair to say that when Donald Trump first floated the idea of the US taking control of Greenland, it seemed fanciful to most people, but does he now have to be taken seriously?
I think we have to take Donald Trump's voice very serious and very concrete as well. I think this has been going on for months now. It's a year since he was bragging, excuse me for the language, about it the first time, and now it has been repeated several times over the last couple of days, even in the aftermath of the attack in Venezuela. So I think we are very worried in Denmark, and they are certainly very worried as well in Greenland.
And the drama just did not stop this week, because on Wednesday afternoon, the seizure by the US military of two tankers, one in the Caribbean, the other a Russian-flagged oil tanker in the North Atlantic, seized for sanctions violations. On Drive Time, Katie spoke to Chris Reynolds, former head of the Irish Coast Guard and head of the EU's counter-piracy mission to Somalia. And she asked him about the legality of the seizure.
Well, first, are they allowed aboard? The straight answer is no. That vessel is entitled to free passage on the high seas. The only reason the US could board it, legally speaking, international law, because the US hasn't ratified the convention that was mentioned earlier on. It doesn't recognize it. But you can board it if you think it's involved in piracy, if you think it's involved in human trafficking or terrorism. And the other reason you can board it is if you think that it's flying an illegal flag. In other words, the flag isn't real and they need to inspect the vessel to board it. So they're the only reasons you can actually do the boarding in the first place.
Yeah. I just see coming in on the wires now, Moscow is now demanding the US allow swift return of the seized tanker's Russian crew. So the crew are in some kind of captivity then in those circumstances, are they?
Yeah, shipping is very complicated. You have the flag and the flag is kind of... The ship is the property of Russia. You're on Russian soil. When you're on a Russian flagship, you're effectively on Russian soil. So the crew on board are entitled to the protection of the Russian government because they are basically standing on Russian soil when they're being arrested. The people who chartered the vessel and the owners of the vessel, they don't have the same rights in a way. But that ship is technically Russian territory. And America is just gone on board Russian territory and detained a Russian-flagged vessel, which is, this is very serious.
From Wednesday's drive time, and in a week of very serious, it was hard to keep up. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Sarah put this to leading international law expert, Professor Philippe Sands.
Lots to discuss. We might start with Venezuela, and most European countries have failed to call out US action there as illegal. Was it illegal, do you think?
It was manifestly illegal. I mean, there are rules on international law on respecting the sovereignty of countries. There are rules on international law on not using force except in self-defense. Those have been manifestly violated. And of course, the idea that one country can accord to itself the right to take over the natural resources, oil in Venezuela, of another country is strictly prohibited. So there's just no doubt, I think, in the international law community, very broadly, that this crosses the line into illegality.
And Sarah asked him about international reaction and response.
And as you say, there hasn't really been outrage, has there? But on the other hand, you have Europe very reliant on the US currently to shore up Ukraine's defence against Russia. So perhaps you can understand the reluctance to speak out against Donald Trump's actions in Venezuela. But does that embolden him then, do you think, or indeed embolden other countries?
Well, he certainly gives the impression that he's emboldened. He's you may have watched, as I did, the interview he gave on board Air Force One. He said it's been a terrific operation. Maybe Cuba next, maybe Colombia. Why not Mexico? Why not Greenland? I mean, again, for your listeners, just imagine the situation. What are we going to do if the United States decides that it's simply going to send troops onto Greenland and take over that territory? Do we just acquiesce? Do we do nothing? I mean, this is a completely new space we have entered into in terms of the Western alliance, in terms of respect for international rules that were put in place in 1945. And I think what's happening is that the silence, the relative silence of most countries, including, for example, the United Kingdom, is born out of a sense of fear that if somehow you speak out against this, you will be the next on his hit list. And that's very, very problematic.
But is that fear justified, do you think?
Well, it may be justified in the sense that he has now shown himself to be willing to take steps that were previously unimaginable. I mean, he has not excluded, when put bluntly the question, do you exclude using force to acquire the area of Greenland? He said no. So I think leaders are right to tread carefully. On the other hand, it's exactly in these kinds of times that you've got to stick to your principles and your values, and you've got to stick together in terms of the direction that you take. But it's a pretty dangerous time.
And there we will leave it for now. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Get ready to squirm.
How are you doing? Did you have a Christmas? Do you celebrate Christmas? your fantasy world, I presume.
Well, first of all, sorry, I'm trying to adjust the microphone. I think it's okay. You can, yeah.
It's very low.
Okay, I'm doing it
for you.
No, don't stay where you are. And thank
lift
you.
Lift it up a little bit.
No, thank you for allowing.
It's muffled there now. There we go. There you're bringing it down.
Thank you. Okay.
Christmas, David.
It's so stressful. It feels like Christmas right now with you. This is exactly what it feels like. It feels like arriving to my, you know, parents' house and the tension in the air.
Oh, I think we're all a little bit tense now. And in case you hadn't copped it, that was Oliver with David McSavage. And that tussle over the mic might be kind of telling. Whose studio is it anyway? Because yes, Oliver, you can ask the question. I just might not answer.
Come here, let's do an interview.
Come here, will you? Sorry. Calm down, Oliver.
You have your children now in showbiz as well. Oh God, I went past there. I actually went back. Your children are in show business too with you.
Oh, you mean what? Because I do a podcast.
You do a podcast with them? You have less showbiz now.
Is it? Anyway, yeah, I do a podcast with my ex-wife,
Hannah.
And my two sons, Jack and Daniel. And the podcast is called And That's Why We're Not Together. And but actually, it feels like, God forgive me, it feels like almost like a second chance to be a good dad or something, because I edit the podcast and it highlights the fact that I am a very bad listener, terrible listener and a terrible interviewer. And I've had guests on the show and Subsequently, I look back in it while editing, and I can see somebody, they might be saying something very interesting, and I'll be desperate to interrupt with something nowhere near as interesting. And you're just looking at yourself as a third person, and you're shocked about it. As I'm even saying it to you now, I'm getting nervous in my belly, thinking about how narcissistic I am. So it's a good kind of therapy. It's good therapy.
Are you saying that you chat to your children on the podcast, but it's only when you listen back to it you actually hear them?
Yeah.
For the first time.
I know. Amazing. There you go. But I feel, you see, I'm speaking authentically and it just feels very uncomfortable.
Oh, you're good at this. You're good at it.
Good at speaking.
What have you learned about your kids then when you listen back to the podcast and you actually hear them?
Such a horrible question. Yeah. And so what have you learned? I've learned that I don't like them. I don't. They bother me. No, I've learned. How articulate and smart they are. You know what I mean? Because, a lot of the times I'm not listening to people. It's really terrible. But in this regard, you know, doing the podcast with my kids, meeting them every week, working with my sons, that feels very good and I'm very grateful. Okay, Oliver, happy now? You know what I mean? Happy now with your intrusive, you know, piercing questions.
Okay, let's try this.
60, when are you 60?
Oh, I'm 60 on the 5th of February. I do know the date, Oliver. Why are you talking to me like you're a psychiatric nurse? You are, that's right. And Davis, do you know the date of your birthday? And yeah, what's going on? They allowed you back on the radio station. I don't want to be here, Oliver. It was just your researcher, Dave, wanted me on because he was friends with my road manager. I like you. Do you do Bob Geldof? Yeah, give us your money.
You're not planning anything then for your 60th, by the sounds of it, if it's on the 5th of February.
No, Oliver, honestly, I'm in denial of it a little bit.
Have you?
To celebrate the fact that I'm getting close to death. You know what I mean? I'm becoming less attractive to the women that I would like to be with.
Dr. Maureen Gaffney, who knows things about ageing, says the 60s are the happiest time of anyone's life. So it's all ahead of you.
Yeah, anything goes. Come on, let's play, you know, bowling. I don't know, is it? Are they the happiest time?
It's going to be the happiest time, yeah. Because now you've matured, you're listening to your children for the first time, even though they're in their 20s. You know, it's going to be a wonderful future.
My God, you're so judgmental. I opened up to you and just bashed me over the head with, I was being vulnerable. God.
Oh, God.
Okay. Oh, God.
Let's have a look at other questions here for you.
National roll of the shoulders there. Release the tension. Dating?
I think basically I find people quite annoying. Now, I'm exaggerating a bit, and I'm not sure what I'm saying is true, but I'm just saying it to see what it sounds like coming out of my mouth, which is, you know, so. But I do get annoyed. Like, I remember I was with a girl there a few weeks ago, right? Went into the kitchen, came back out, and then she greeted me as I came back from the kitchen as if she hadn't seen me for. And she made this sound. She went, like, in a cutesy way, she went, "Hi," like that. She just went, "Hi." And I just thought, I never want to see that. This woman again.
I think her pitch was kind of saying the same thing, wasn't it?
What?
Hi. Was it kind of a, I'm leaving now? I'm assuming.
Okay, very good. Very good, Oliver. Yeah. I think she was trying to be all cutesy or whatever. But anyway, what I'm saying is I have very low threshold and I'm very... people are annoying.
Well, they certainly can be. Now, they did talk about McSavage's work in Ukraine and his home gym, but oh, sweet God, the tension.
Have you ever thought about being a guard, have you?
It was unique.
Have you ever thought about being a guard?
No, I didn't. No, never have.
You do have a detective energy about you. Like, you, I'm looking at you and you're...
I wouldn't have passed the physical test.
You reckon you've figured me out. So you do. You have that look. I feel guilty sitting in front of you, Oliver.
I haven't a clue of who you are or what you're about.
So said in a way that you do know exactly what I'm thinking. It's amazing. That's a skill. You're very interesting.
Ooh, as the nation rocks back and forth. David McSavage with Oliver. And if you were a little bit on edge there, well, steel yourself for Thursday's Liveline. Ciarán Cuddihy was taking calls on the ICE shooting of US citizen Renee Nicole Good. Lynette had phoned in from Minneapolis, where she had been a witness at the scene of the shooting.
When I got to about the middle of the street, I heard three quick pops. that I knew instantly was gunfire, because I've been living in this neighborhood for 40 years, and, well, probably I would know anyway, just because I live in the United States. Yeah, and so, and then shortly after, another bang, which would turn out to be her hitting a parked car across the street. I mean, she obviously had been shot and then, you know, couldn't control the car anymore, but it had been in drive, and so it ran into a parked car across the street. So then I started running to the scene and trying to figure it out, and by this point I was far enough down that there were ICE officers in front of me, and they were preventing people from getting close to her at that point. And they had their guns in the air, they had their canisters of tear gas or whatever they've got up in the air threatening us. And
Ciarán took calls from listeners living in the US and also here in Ireland. They were giving their views on what had happened, what they'd seen in person and online. But at about 20 past two, Owen phoned in. Things took a turn.
I regard the way ICE are behaving as outrageous, but Trump campaigned on illegal immigration as his primary focus in this particular presidency. He tried to do it in the first presidency, but once he got in, he never really got around to doing what he's doing now. The problem wasn't as serious, as I've said, because Biden let in a further 10 million. Even though the problem had been apparent for at least a decade previously of Trump getting in the first time. So the way the incident is being portrayed, where this poor woman lost her life, is that she was an innocent abroad, that she just happened to get stuck in the middle of the road, and all of a sudden a tragedy ensued.
Excuse me for a moment, don't interrupt me.
Don't woman-splain, okay?
But she's an American citizen.
Don't woman-splain, please. Don't woman-splain.
And that was the line that would pretty much dominate the rest of the programme. Yes, there were arguments about the videos and motivations, but really after that, it became more of an argument about how to argue.
To try and get out of the way of the car, of the policeman who was trying to open her door, her driver's door. She reversed back. She then sped off, clipping the second policeman that came in front of her car. Now, she could have endangered. There was two cars parked.
You know, I was
parked.
There, and I have
you're
video.
You're explaining again.
You are
on video from three different angles. I've micro-analysed this. You're woman-splaining again.
Owen, can I ask you a question?
I'm not going to be interrupted.
No, Owen, I'm just asking you.
Why are you not stopping her interrupting me?
Owen, I'm just asking you a question. What's woman-splaining? What's woman-splaining?
You know exactly what woman-splaining
is. No, I don't. Lynette was there on the scene and she was ready to explain what she saw.
You're one of the most woke presenters on Irish media. You know exactly what it is.
No, go on. You tell me what do you think it is. What do you think it is?
I couldn't be bothered. I want to explain what I'm trying to explain.
You want a platform to speak uninterrupted and nobody to challenge your views, which isn't what you're going to get on Liveline, regardless of what your views are, whether you think they're woke or not. I'm asking you a question.
I will explain to you what woman-splaining is on one condition, that you stop those progressive so-called interrupting me. Is that a deal?
I'm not necessarily. I'm not going to sign up to that deal. I mean, I'm not going to let people on air speak uninterrupted regardless of what they're saying. It depends on what you say.
That woman interrupted me within about 20 seconds of me opening my mouth. You've had five woke callers on in the first half an hour. I'm the first person who's coming on. Now, I don't particularly like Trump, but I've heard this anti-Republican, and it's now anti-MAGA, rhetoric on the Irish media for 40 years. Anytime there's a Republican president in, whether it's Reagan or either of the Bushes, and now Trump, it's wall-to-wall invective against Republicans.
They took a break. And then, brave or foolish, you decide. Rachel phoned in.
Rachel, what have you made of this conversation?
Oh, God. First off, Happy New Year, Ciarán.
Same to you.
Second of all, can I be honest, listening to that man there with his woman slaying him? He's after driving me mad. Men say things. Any person that speaks to another person like that does it to deflect, because they cannot like, they don't like being challenged. And they don't like someone else saying that they may be wrong on things. That's my experience and my belief. And as for his progressiveness, he's no way progressive at all. Do you know what I mean? I've never heard someone so backwards in my life and so contradictory in their words.
And now it was that use of the word backward that would elicit this response.
Stop insulting me. Stop insulting me.
You started by insulting that woman.
Excuse me, there you go. I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
Stop insulting me.
Rachel, let Owen make his point. Go on, Owen.
Okay, sorry.
What was the question?
About the charge of backwardness. Well, I think you had a go at me for not correcting Rachel about what you had said. But I guess, Owen, the beauty of having you here was that I knew you would correct her. So anyway,
I didn't want to interrupt her.
Yeah.
I didn't want to interrupt her. And there's a good chance that I was going to be exited from the programme to get other people on.
I was always going to let you come back and respond to somebody who was talking specifically about you in some context.
You know that that was not the definitive answer to my accusation about being accused of justifying the killing. The cop should not have shot her.
I know, and you said that to us as well. You were quite explicit. Okay. You said that.
Okay, so this issue of backwardness. Unfortunately, if anyone listens back to my contribution and that last woman's contribution, the only person that will be deemed to be backward is not me. It's the other person who accused me of being backwards.
Why?
No, I do believe you're backwards.
Because she was all over the place. If you stop for five seconds,
Rachel, I'll tell you what, Rachel, let Owen explain why he thinks you're backward, and then I'll let you respond.
Okay, yeah, no, that's fine.
Owen.
Okay, this is 100% proof that she is backward.
Okay.
She came on the programme without even looking at the full video of the car hitting. She also said that because she was dead, her foot was on the accelerator, whereas almost 99.9% of vehicles in America are automatic. It's in drive. You even said that to her. She didn't know what you were talking about. That's backwards.
Ooh, I think my head hurts. And it would turn out that Owen was an equal opportunities individual when it came to scrapping. Even with Daniel, a one-time Republican voter.
You're going to have to open up your ears. Okay? I haven't come on here.
So
I spent 20 minutes analysing three of the videos. Don't say I just watched one video.
Okay. So I'm trying to have a conversation with you, and instead you go to
an ad hominem. You're misrepresenting me.
And I apologize. Didn't I apologize for that? And I apologize, and you come back with me with a personal attack. This is what I'm talking about. This is what
I started in on. Because you're misrepresenting me.
That when people...
I apologize to you if you come on with a high-minded attitude, criticizing me for being stupid. You cannot be stupid.
I never used that word.
Owen,
you're using that word. I never used that word.
You're implying I'm stupid.
I did not say that at all.
A Republican supporter.
No.
So you weren't implying I was stupid.
I told you, I used to be Republican support. I used to be in the Republican Party. I vote for Republicans from time to time. Okay? You are using that. You're the one that are attacking people. Nobody is attacking you. I was pointing out parts of what you were saying. That's not a personal attack.
They were all attacking me.
Well, Owen, they disagreed with your views, but I mean,
That's fine.
I know.
He cannot say that I wasn't being attacked when I was. I don't mind being attacked.
Owen, can I say something? Owen, you're the one interrupting me now. But there's only one person on the show who has called other people stupid today, and it's you, and you've called Daniel and Rachel stupid.
Yes, because they've proven they are.
I know, but
they're accusing me. They're implying
you're the only
I'm
person
stupid.
Calling people names.
Oh. But they've proven they are stupid.
Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Yesterday, 25 years in the making, and it finally got through.
Good afternoon. Ireland has voted no to the EU-Mercosur trade agreement, but EU ambassadors have approved the deal by a qualified majority. post-mortem.
So, despite apparent wobbles from the government earlier in the week, it was a no from Ireland. And on the run-up to yesterday's vote, a lot of discussion about the possible impact on the dairy farmer. The fear that cheap South American beef of, they say, inferior quality would flood the EU market. With David McCullough on Tuesday, a head-to-head, yes, another scrap. He spoke to Francie Gorman, president of the IFA, and Darren McCullough.
No relation.
Farmer and broadcaster.
I'm questioning the fear that is being stoked amongst the farming and indeed the rural community about Mercosur. You know, there was IFA were quoting figures that any Mercosur deal was going to cost farming, the farm sector, well over 100 million euros a year. That research was based on analysis by the meat processors, the meat factories, who obviously have a lot of skin in the game. But there's other research from agricultural economists, very well regarded economists such as Professor Alan Matthews, and indeed Chagas' own economic research unit, which suggests that there will be little or no impact from Mercosur on beef farming incomes. And that's very different from what we're hearing from the farm organisations who, you know, I received a text on my phone yesterday flagging this protest that's been organised in Athlone on Saturday. And it's pretty dire, you know, fairly trenchant stuff. I mean, it starts off with silence isn't neutral, it's acceptance. This is about more than protest. It's about the future of rural Ireland. You know, once it's gone, it's gone. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, farmers being marched up to the top of a hill here to protest about Mercosur, with all the real facts at hand.
And a firm pushback on this from the IFA.
Firstly, we for 20, 25 years from the time these negotiations started, we've been ultra consistent in our opposition to this, based on two things. Firstly, the economic viability and the impact it was going to have at farm level. And there's no question that if you bring in beef into Europe, into a market that's a mature market, That also has the effects of other trade deals, not just with Mercosur, the potential of other trade deals with other countries, the potential effect that trade deals Britain are doing are going to have on our ability to be able to export into Britain. It's going to have an effect on price. And we're not marching farmers up to the top of the hill in any way. And I think the ultimate point to be made about this is the food recall that the European Union did themselves about 2 months ago, where they recalled beef that came in through Rotterdam to 12 European countries and was consumed by consumers in Italy, containing a hormone that's been banned in Europe for decades. So it's about economics, it's about public health, it's about fairness. And I think that this is a bad deal. It hasn't in any way protected our beef industry here. We export 90% of what we produce. And the UK is our best market. It's one of the highest value markets in the world. And if that's impacted, you're going to see an impact in terms of income at farm level. But there is the public health issue as well. And I think that's a huge issue that's been overlooked and is equally as important.
And they got right into it. But towards the end of the debate, Darren McCullough made the point that similar fears had been raised by farmers with Brexit, but those fears had not been realised.
To equate the Brexit that we voted with, that was voted for, and the Brexit we have today, like, there's no comparison. What we were looking at that point in time is a hard Brexit, and be under no doubt that if these trade deals continue to be done in the way they are, the impact on income at farm level, particularly, it's fine if you're a flour farmer in County Meath, but if you're a suckler farmer in the west of Ireland and you're looking at the value of your weanlings for the first time ever in this year, gone up to where they need to be, looking at that being undermined through a combination of trade deals and what will definitely happen in the way inflation will eat into our margins in the coming years, you're staring down the barrel of a gun.
OK, Dara, I better let you in on that. I presume the flower grower in Meath was you.
Yeah, there's not too many other flower growers in Meath. Look, I go back...
Let him answer, Francie, please.
You know, if Francie wants to dismiss and disregard Alan Matthews and the regulators and all the other points I make, the one point that I come back with is...
Why are Chagask saying that Mercosur deal won't have a big impact on beef farmers? Like, I mean, if you dismiss what your own agricultural research authority is saying about this deal, then I don't know what you're to believe in the world anymore.
And then for a finish, right of reply.
Chagas's figures don't show, in my opinion, the same level of loss that we believe
so
that farmers are going to...
Chagas's research.
Dara, let Francie finish, please.
I'm not dismissing Chagas at all. I'm quite entitled to have our own view on it. And we've been ultra consistent on this. It's not just about figures, Dara. It's also about public health. And I think to be as dismissive of the public health issue as you are is completely irresponsible. And that's why we're in the situation we're in now. And if the European Union continue to do deals like this, they're undermining their own commitments to public health based on ambitions that they have and the WHO have. And they can't have it both ways. We are not anti-trade. We export 90% of what we produce. We just want fair trade.
OK, I doubt we're going to reach a meeting of minds here, but Dara, just a final...
David McCullough summing up what might well be the phrase of the week. Now, at this stage, you might be wondering, was it all scrapping 24/7 for the week that was in it? Well, there was a lot of it. Even when it came to the film reviews on Arena, it was not all plain sailing. We give you Hamlet. Paul Mescal as Shakespeare, Jessie Buckley acting out of her skin as Agnes, his wife as they grieve the death of their son. Surely this is an unqualified triumph. With Rick, Donald Clarke and Serena Bellissimo.
Serena, do you have reservations?
Yeah, I do. I have to say, look, when I walked out of this film, the first thing I thought was, if I could hang a piece of cinema in the Louvre, this would be it. I think it's art at its finest form. It is a masterpiece. I don't think this is going to be for everybody, though. And that's not... I don't want that to take away from the film, because I do think it's a great film. But
it's interesting that it's done well awards so far, particularly for Jessie, but it's won audience prizes everywhere. It won the audience prize at Toronto International Film Festival, and that's punters as well as experts.
That is film buffs. People who go to film festivals mm-hmm. are into film, sure, are into the fair. Art form. And that's not to say if you don't like this, you're not a film buff and stuff, but I just think that in January, when you're trying to escape from everything, this is very heavy. And I just think that if you're going for escapism, this isn't the film for you. I also have read I went onto Rotten Tomatoes going, is it just the critics who are giving this major kudos? Really funny, has a higher audience rating than a critic rating. Mm. But where the audience are saying they're a bit let down, they're just going, I feel like it's going on for a little bit too long.
Maybe, and this is something that might connect to that, Serena, the idea that, and I've seen it being referred to as, again, very large air quotes, grief porn.
Yeah, but I think the way it has been done, I don't know if I would go down that route, because there's so much that happens before that. And like you were both talking about not wanting to give spoilers, but the fact that we know that the son dies, and I was still in shock when the son dies, will tell you how well this film is put together. Like you can go in and know everything about this film, but then you will get so lost in it that when you're going, no, this is definitely going down one way. I don't know why they told me the son was going to die. And then it happens and you're still left in shock. That's clunky.
Well, I also say I don't buy this criticism at all. I mean, grief is a fit subject for a serious film or novel. And, if you're going to call this grief porn, then you can call, bicycle thieves poverty porn, or you could call taxi driver lunatic porn. These are fit subjects for films to treat, and it is, I think, crazy to suggest that it's not treated in some depth and with some nuance.
Fair enough, but there was consensus on this.
In terms of Jessie Buckley's chances of winning an Oscar, Serena?
If she doesn't, there's something wrong.
Donald?
I think she's the biggest favourite in 10 or 15 years. The only person who could beat her, I would say, is Rose Byrne from an upcoming film called If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. We'll see what happens with the Globes on Sunday. We expect them both to win because they're in separate categories. Mm-hmm. Rose Byrne's in the comedy section. I think she's the only person who could beat her, and she could beat her. She won a lot of Critics Award, Rose Byrne, but I think Buckley is safe.
Come on, the Golden Globes. And after all that...
OK, let me get some stars from both of you, Donald.
I'm going the full five. Why not? Why budget?
Can I give two? Can I give five?
I was concerned you're giving two.
Yeah, you said two.
Really interesting conversation. Okay.
No, I'm giving two ratings. I'm giving five as a piece of art. I think it's amazing. But I think as it's not going to be for everyone, so I'm going to give it a four as well for, yeah.
From Arena. Now, it has been a fierce news week. January kicking ass in that department. But let's carry over some vestige of goodwill into the new year. Maybe we all need a little dose of Harding.
Do you make New Year's resolutions, by the way? Are you one of these people?
I don't know. No, I don't. But I really... This is getting at the deep end now, Oliver. But
is it really?
It is. Instead of making resolutions, I kind of become watchful to see what opportunities would arise.
I see.
That's the trick. Now, some people then sort of grasp the future with a kind of a clenched fist. I am going to do this, that and the other. I do the opposite. I open the hand
right
in a meditative posture and open the heart and say, what will arise for me today?
So you're not going out to grab it?
No, I'm paying attention to whatever happens. And sometimes it's some surprise happens, you know. And if you're paying attention to the world, you'll find opportunities.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because I don't think that we...
Paying attention is a skill we've lost.
Yeah. We don't create our life. We think we do. Mm. You know, we think we make the big decisions in our life and we have to. But in actual fact, if you look back on your life, you realise you didn't make any of the big decisions that changed your life. No. They just happened to you.
No free will at all.
In a sense, there isn't. Only in the response you have to life. I think that's where the free will is.
And if you do feel like hunkering down and just taking it easy, you're in good company.
We're giving ourselves too much punishment
yeah.
about relaxing. So it's like people say, I'm doing this to relax. Right? I'm going to do Tai Chi to relax. I'm going to do line dancing to relax. I'm going to do all these things to relax. And it's like clenched fist. You're going to make an effort to relax. But the answer is, how do you kind of unlock that? It's like loosening the grip of your hand. You can do it physically. And the way to do it is to realise that when you're relaxing, you're doing nothing. You don't take up something else to relax. Mm-hmm. If you're wanting to relax, stop where you are. Stop. Do nothing for 20 minutes. Absolutely nothing. Don't even change your posture. You know, don't even start fussing about, am I sitting right
yeah.
in the lotus position?
Right?
No, just be aware of yourself. And be still and realise the mystery to be alive is the whole trick. It's the whole trick of happiness, that we're alive. Mm-hmm. We are blessed.
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.